Very good morning to everyone. The first case on our call this morning is number 014186, Patrick Hampton against Blair Liebach. Ms. Kahn.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Assistant Attorney General Huma Khan on behalf of Respondent Appellant. Your Honor, we're here before this Court today on the District Court's erroneous granting of a writ of habeas petition. In granting the writ for habeas, the District Court misapplied and ignored procedural default rules. The District Court misapplied the requirements set forth in Strickland v. Washington when it found ineffectiveness on part of defense counsel for failure to call three witnesses, namely Ronnie Gardner, Clinton Williams, and Gregory Mallory. And the District Court erroneously held an evidentiary hearing. Before turning to the merits of the case, this Court must consider if a petitioner has fulfilled procedural requirements. I submit that the only claims for ineffectiveness assistance of counsel are of Ronnie Gardner and Clinton Williams. Any other individuals are procedurally defaulted. First, Your Honor, Gregory Hubbard, we submit, is procedurally defaulted on fair presentment grounds. The District Court on its own appeared to include this new issue of whether defense counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate or call Gregory Hubbard. It was never raised below. It was never raised in the post-conviction petition. It was never raised on appeal from the post-conviction petition.
Could you say the last one? Gregory what?
Gregory Hubbard. It was raised for the first time by the District Court on its own initiative. That, Your Honor, runs afoul clearly of fair presentment rules. The only tangential relationship of Gregory Hubbard in this case is that he is named in the post-conviction petition, but with respect to a co-defendant, who is Ronald Mallory. Ronald Mallory had called Gregory Hubbard as a witness. However, the petitioner here, Patrick Hampton, never alleged that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate Gregory Hubbard.
Now, what authority do you rely on for the proposition that having raised in the state court the whole question of ineffective assistance and failure to investigate witnesses, that it was incumbent upon counsel in the state court to raise the particulars with respect to each and every one of these witnesses? Is there square authority on point on that proposition?
Your Honor, most recently in Boyko, this court has held that although claims do not have to be exactly the same, however, they must not add to a specific claim, and they must not and the operative facts have to be before the state court, and controlling legal principles have to be before the state court.
The state court dismissed Mr. Hampton's ineffectiveness claim out of hand without conducting any sort of a hearing. And if, as Judge Kennelly reasoned, the state court's analysis was wrong, didn't that open the door to the hearing? And
there was a hearing on his right to testify, not on the ineffectiveness. Yes, there was no hearing on that. However, if you look at the facts, Your Honor, we have all of these characters out there. Gregory Hubbard, we maintain, is procedurally defaulted. Farood Poole is clearly procedurally defaulted on fair presentment grounds. The state court, PCP court, state appellate court, the Illinois Supreme Court never had a chance to consider those arguments with respect to Gregory Hubbard and with Farood Poole.
Well, sure they did. If they conducted a hearing, they would have, all of this would have come before them.
Your Honor, it was never,
or all of this might not have come before them, but we're never going to know this.
No, but it was never alleged by the petitioner that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to raise these individuals. That is the whole thing.
Is there a case that says that he has to raise it with respect to each individual?
Your Honor, he has to make specific claims. The Post-Conviction Hearing Act specifies that for each and every claim alleged, there must be an affidavit attached. Here, Gregory Hubbard, there was no affidavit attached. For Farood Poole, there was no...
But the central tenet of Hampton's claim was raised in state court, and that was that his trial attorney had failed to contact and present exculpatory witnesses. That was plainly presented, and it was well supported by the affidavits of other witnesses.
I may disagree with that, Your Honor. His claim that was presented is that defense counsel failed to investigate Clinton Williams and Ronnie Gardner. That is what his claim specified. He attached affidavits in relation to that specification. He attached affidavits from Clinton Williams and Ronnie Gardner in his post-conviction petition.
But the testimony would be in the very same vein as the other exculpatory witnesses whose affidavits were submitted to the state court. So Mallory's testimony, for instance, although it's important, it doesn't, to my mind, change the nature of Hampton's claim, nor does it catch anyone by surprise.
Your Honor, if you're asking whether Mallory's affidavit, which was attached at the time the supplemental habeas petition was filed, it certainly changes the nature of the claim, because it not only adds onto the claim, but it's a new and distinct claim onto itself.
Is there authority for that, though? That is considered a new and distinct claim as opposed to simply supporting evidence for the claim that this lawyer just failed to look into exculpatory witnesses. He didn't do a thing.
Your Honor, we maintain the authority for that lies in numerous decisions. One is Boyko, as I mentioned before, where this court has cautioned that the habeas arena is not the arena to go and allege new claims. You cannot add a new claim. For instance, in Boyko, this court allowed a transcript, the record to be expanded. A transcript could be added on to a claim that was originally raised before. I believe in Boyko, the petitioner there said that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to raise the defense of post-traumatic stress disorder. And there was a transcript which related specifically to that. Petitioner there said that the defense counsel should have known from that transcript that there could have been a defense of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's not the case here. This is a new claim that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate or failing to contact Gregory Hubbard, failing to investigate or failing to contact Ruth Poole. We further submit with regard to Gregory Hubbard, there is no affidavit attached at all, not even in the supplemental habeas petition.
Well, let me ask you this. In the final analysis, what support is there in the record for the state court's assertion that Mr. Rodkin made a legitimate tactical decision not to present not one of the exculpatory witnesses? And how could he have made such a decision without at least interviewing the witnesses? How do you do that?
Sure. I can go through the witnesses one by one, which would be the easiest since there seem to be so many characters here. With regard to Gregory Hubbard,
said the same as Gregory Mallory.
No, Your Honor, there are two distinct witnesses.
Right,
Gregory Hubbard was never raised anywhere. There's no affidavit that closes the author's care presentment grounds. Harut Poole, first time he was raised was in an affidavit on the supplemental post-conviction petition. We have nothing else. Post-conviction court never considered him. The appellate court never considered him. PLA did not have, Illinois Supreme Court did not have any opportunity to consider that. However, I would like to state in that the district court did say that Harut Poole was procedurally defaulted, not on fair presentment grounds, but by the fact that there was no due diligence on part of petitioner to raise him. That leaves Gregory Mallory, Ronnie Gardner, and Clinton Williams. Those are kind of the main individuals here. Gregory Mallory, we maintain, is procedurally defaulted on independent and adequate state grounds. The Illinois Appellate Court noted in its opinion that under post-conviction law, you need to attach an affidavit to each and every specific claim. That's post-conviction law, and Your Honor, that's 725 ILCS 5/122-2.
Did the state appellate court nevertheless go on, though, to consider that claim?
What the state appellate court did do is, after it noted that you needed to attach that under post-conviction law, it noted that despite defendant's contention, there was no affidavit attached. It did not consider the merits of Gregory Mallory, and that's buttressed by the fact that dissenting counsel noted that, went back and said the majority explained why Gregory Mallory was not called. Clearly, Your Honor, they meant for it to be defaulted. That leaves Ronnie Gardner, Clinton Williams. Ronnie Gardner pled guilty to the very same incident that Hampton was charged, and in his guilty plea, he implicated Hampton for the crime. Gardner said, yeah, I did it, and Hampton did it right along with me. And
What did he say he did?
He said he committed the aggravated battery. He assaulted, he basically brutally raped two victims, robbed three. He was there. I mean, it was a horrendous incident. In 1981, in the International Amphitheater, there was an R&B concert.
When did he plead?
He pled guilty shortly thereafter.
Before the trial?
Yes, before the trial he pled guilty. And Hampton was at his change of plea hearing, and he had heard that Ronnie Gardner had implicated Patrick Hampton, and that was a factual basis during the change of plea hearing that, you know, Ronnie Gardner pled guilty and he implicated Patrick Hampton. That leaves one individual, Clinton Williams. Clinton Williams is currently deceased. We have his affidavit from 1991, and he's by far the least compelling. His affidavit, if we take his affidavit in the best light possible, it doesn't state much. What it does say is that I've been childhood friends with Patrick Hampton. He's my best friend, in fact. He didn't sit with Patrick Hampton. He sat, I believe, behind Patrick Hampton. I mean, he's presumably at a concert to watch the concert, not keep an eye on Patrick Hampton. Beyond that, he doesn't say much. He says, I didn't see Patrick Hampton go into the circle. There was this circle where 30 to 40 men just converged upon these three victims and just started assaulting them, robbing them, raping them, and so forth. He says, Patrick Hampton, I didn't see him go into the circle. Beyond that, he says nothing else. And most notably, these affidavits, Clinton Williams' affidavit, Ronnie Gardner's affidavit, and even for purposes of this oral argument, Gregory Mallory's affidavit, they all conflict amongst each other and with Patrick Hampton's affidavit. So right there, you certainly, Your Honor, there's certainly a lot of doubt on whether any of these individuals are telling the truth. For instance,
this probably could have been determined, though, if the state court had held a hearing.
Your Honor, it's I think what we're kind of losing here is that there's not a lot of characters here. The claim is just premised upon basically two, or for the sake of this argument, three individuals. We have Gregory Mallory, we have Clinton Williams, and Ronnie Gardner. Ronnie Gardner pled guilty, and the district court does concede in a footnote no less on page 30, I believe, of its decision that it was reasonable for defense counsel not to call Gardner. So that leaves us with two, Gregory Mallory and Clinton Williams. Again, Gregory Mallory, Your Honor, we maintain it's procedurally defaulted. However, if for the purposes of this argument that this court does not want to consider the procedural default argument, there's a lot of things which go against Gregory Mallory. Let's look at what defense counsel had in his folder at the time of trial. What defense counsel had was a pre-trial statement from Ronald Mallory. Ronald Mallory is a co-defendant of Patrick Hampton. At that time, in that pre-trial statement, Ronald Mallory...
Stay up close.
Oh, I apologize. Ronald Mallory testified to the fact that he went to the concert only with Gregory Mallory, nobody else. Both of them sat in the balcony. They did not see anybody they knew there. That's what Ronald Mallory testified to. That's what Rogden had. So for Hampton to say, oh, I sat with Gregory Mallory. Oh, I snuck into the concert with Gregory Mallory. We were sitting there the whole time. I left with Gregory Mallory, directly counters what Ronald Mallory is stating. That no, I sat with my brother. So Gregory Mallory and I sat up in the balcony. We didn't see anybody we knew there. We left there without seeing anybody we knew. That directly counters what Hampton is saying about Gregory Mallory. So that definitely precludes defense counsel from calling Gregory Mallory. That leaves Clinton Williams. And again, I submit Clinton Williams is really the weakest out of all three. Clinton Williams did not sit with them. So if Hampton's contention is, look, I have an individual who can say, I didn't do it, how can Clinton Williams really testify when he wasn't there with Hampton the whole time? If we have someone like Ronnie Gardner, who Patrick Hampton is alleging, yeah, Ronnie Gardner sat with me the whole time, that's different than Clinton Williams, who sat, he didn't sit with him, I don't know if he sat.
Ms. Cunningham, your time has expired.
Oh, I apologize. May I conclude?
In a sentence or so, that's it.
We just respectfully request that this honorable court reverse the decision of the district court and deny habeas relief. Thank you,
Ms. Cunningham. We'll hear now from Mr. Whitney.
May it please the court. 8 months before trial, Patrick Hampton provided his lawyer with the names and addresses of three individuals who were with him at the concert, who knew that he was not involved in these attacks, and who would have testified on his behalf at trial. Patrick Hampton's lawyer never made a single attempt to contact any one of those witnesses or any of the other exculpatory witnesses that were identified in the discovery materials. At trial, Patrick Hampton's lawyer did not present a single witness to contradict the state's identification testimony. The issue in this appeal is whether it was reasonable for the state courts to conclude that Patrick Hampton received, quote, highly competent representation, and whether it was reasonable for the state courts to dismiss as merely redundant the witnesses who would have testified that Patrick Hampton did not commit the crimes for which he was charged. The district court properly concluded that these were unreasonable conclusions, that they represented an unreasonable application of Strickland v. Washington.
Was even the statement of the law correct? As I recall, the state court at one point said that the misstated the Strickland test, actually.
You're absolutely correct, Judge Ripple. What the state court said was that Mr. Hampton had to prove by a preponderance that the outcome would have been different. Strickland itself said that was erroneous. Again, in Williams, the Supreme Court has emphasized that's a clearly erroneous application of the Strickland standard. As this court is well aware, the application under Strickland is there a reasonable probability, a reasonable likelihood that the outcome would have been different had counsel performed a minimally competent investigation? In its presentation this morning, the state cannot cite to one piece of evidence in this record to even suggest that Patrick Hampton's lawyer made any effort to factually investigate his case, any effort to contact witnesses that were identified 8 months before trial for him. The law is by now well established. A lawyer has an unequivocal duty to investigate a client's case and to contact potential witnesses.
Now, Mr. Whitney, your colleague representing the state indicates to us that the law is that that in the state courts one needed to raise by affidavit each and every one of these witnesses in order for us to consider the testimony or the proper testimony of each one of those witnesses with respect to your claim. What do you say to that?
Judge, I think that's an incorrect statement of federal procedural default law. And I think what you said, Your Honor, was the proper focus is not what on state law is, but what the state appellate court wrote in its opinion. The test under Harris is, did the state appellate court clearly and expressly rely on a violation of state procedural rules in dismissing the claim?
Didn't Justice O'Brien, in her dissenting opinions, appear to indicate that in fact they were relying on procedural default witness law with respect to the one witness whose affidavit was not attached?
Justice O'Brien did say that they explained away the Mallory affidavit.
That's
she did
right.
not, however, like the majority, cite to any specific portion of Illinois procedural law, any portion of the Illinois Post-Conviction Act, and did not, the majority in a one-sentence rebuttal of an assertion made apparently in Mr. Hampton's brief, said the Mallory affidavit had not been attached. It went on to clearly address the merits in both prongs of the Strickland analysis.
In your view, did the state court consider the claim to be, in effect, a unitary one of failure to interview witnesses, or as multiple claims with respect to each witness?
I think just the headings of the state court opinion will tell you, Your Honor, that they considered a failure to investigate claim generally. That's how they broke up the opinion. And they analyzed the failure to investigate claim on the merits under Strickland and said without any factual basis that Mr. Rogden had a reasonable basis not to attempt to even contact one exculpatory witness.
Mallory's testimony, I think, you'll agree, is very important. Tell me this. Did it change the nature of Mr. Hampton's claim?
Are you talking about from state court to federal court? It did not, Your Honor.
Right. Did it come as some enormous shock to the state?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. In Mr. Hampton's affidavit in support of a state post-conviction petition, Mr. Hampton specifically stated in that affidavit, I gave the name of Gregory Mallory to Mr. Rogden and told him that Mallory would confirm where I sat during the concert and he would confirm that I was not involved. Gregory Mallory was fairly presented to the state courts. They were fully aware of the claim of Gregory Mallory. Gregory Mallory's trial testimony was also referenced in the state post-conviction petition. With respect to Gregory Hubbard, I feel like I need to correct the factual record. If the court would look at page 12 of Mr. Hampton's supplemental post-conviction in state court, it stated that the testimony of Gregory Hubbard further demonstrated Rogden's failure to investigate Patrick Hampton's claim, Patrick Hampton's defense. And then it cited the specific portion of the trial transcript, page 1145, in which Hubbard testified on behalf of Gregory Mallory. And when Hubbard testified on behalf of Gregory Mallory, what he said was, I was at the concert, I was on the main floor, I was near the attack. He was asked if Patrick Hampton was one of the people involved, and he said no. Patrick Hampton's jury never heard that testimony. They didn't hear that testimony because Rogden, Patrick Hampton's lawyer, never made any attempt to contact Gregory Hubbard. How do we know that Rogden was aware of Gregory Hubbard? Because in his trial folder, there was a witness list submitted on behalf of co-defendant Ronald Mallory. It did not just list the name of Gregory Hubbard. It listed Gregory Hubbard's address. So Rogden knew of Gregory Hubbard. He knew how to get in touch with him. Yet again, he made absolutely no effort to contact a witness who would have testified that Patrick Hampton did not commit the crime for which he was charged.
Could I jump ahead? I mean, we've talked a long time about whether or not they should have had the hearing and whether there should have been procedural default. I would like to focus a little bit on the actual who could have said what and who did say what. As you know, there are three people at the trial who identified Hampton. You have, I believe it's her name, Martha.
That's
the
right.
One he attacked. She said she attacked him, ripped off her pants, and grabbed her vagina. You also have Denise, who said that she saw Patrick Hampton jam this hard, cold object into her vagina. You have the police officer who was on security duty that night who said he saw Hampton jamming her and he helped pull him off of her. Now, those are three eyewitnesses that his jury did hear. And one of the defenses seemed to be that it was too dark to really identify. And yet, the witnesses that you are saying should have been there all say they could see well. Now, is that a reason not to call those people if your defense is that the three eyewitnesses, the three people who were closest, could say, yes, I saw him, it was him?
Your Honor, at first I would say, whether or not it was a reasonable decision to call or not to call, we don't get to because Rogden never made any attempt to even contact him, interview them, or find out what they would have said. And this court has said in Sullivan, a counsel can't make credibility determinations about a witness's potential testimony without first making some effort to contact the witness. With respect to the actual effect of the witness's testimony, Your Honor, I would point out that the state's identification testimony in this case was completely uncorroborated. It was uncorroborated by physical evidence. It was uncorroborated by any inculpatory statements or admissions or any testimony of co-defendants. So you have identification testimony that was given under circumstances that could not have been more conducive to misidentification. It was a horrific assault. I do not dispute that, Your Honor. It was in a dark and crowded and noisy amphitheater.
It was dark.
That's correct.
And that was one of the reasons I was curious how these other witnesses who were at a distance and could see.
I think the best evidence of the effect of the darkness is Ronald Mallory's trial, Your Honor. Ronald Mallory was in a similar situation to Mr. Hampton. He was on the floor. He did not participate in the attack. He called three occurrence witnesses who, like Mr. Hampton's witnesses, were in this crowded and dark amphitheater, but testified they saw Ronald Mallory during the attacks. The lighting was good enough for them to see that Ronald Mallory was not involved.
Bob, would you concede that, given the state's case against Ronald Mallory was not as strong as the case against Hampton, that
there were certainly there weren't as many witnesses identifying Patrick Hampton. There's no question about that, Your Honor.
You have one.
I mean, there weren't as many witnesses identifying Ronald Mallory, I'm sorry. So there were more identifications of Patrick Hampton. But I want to note that Ronald Mallory was acquitted, despite the darkness, because his witnesses testified that they could see him and he did not participate in the attacks. The test under Strickland is not can we demonstrate, as the state court said, that Patrick Hampton would have been acquitted. But is there a reasonable likelihood? If the jury had heard three people come into court and say that Patrick Hampton was there, I was sitting with him, or I was sitting next to him, I saw him during these attacks, I know that he did not do it.
Well, you couldn't call Gardner, who had pleaded and said that he was there. I think the district court actually acknowledged
that. The district court did not rely on Gardner's opinion. That's correct, Your Honor.
We do have at least two.
At least, I believe three, Your
Honor. I guess I'm not familiar with Hubbard. I missed him for some reason.
Hubbard testified, and again, it's at page 1145 of the trial transcript, on behalf of co-defendant Ronald Mallory. He basically testified consistent with the other witnesses, which is I was at the concert, I was on the floor near the attacks, and I saw Ronald Mallory, and he didn't participate in the attacks. And again, Ronald Mallory was acquitted of all counts. Mr. Hubbard also testified in front of Mallory's jury that he didn't see Hampton as one of the attackers, too. Clearly exculpatory testimony. So the district court properly considered Hubbard's testimony. Again, that specific portion of the trial transcript was referenced in Mr. Hampton's state supplemental petition.
So Hubbard told, this case was tried, the prosecutor tried it to all three juries.
That's correct.
Then each defense counsel tried it to the jury for his defendant.
That's correct.
So Hubbard, the counsel for this other fellow asked Hubbard to testify. Counsel for your client did not.
That's correct.
And your claim is, well, that's a big difference.
And only the Mallory jury heard Hubbard exculpate Mr. Hampton. Mr. Hampton's own jury did not hear Hubbard exculpate him, he didn't hear a single witness, single one of the many witnesses who could have come into court and said, I was there, I witnessed it, Patrick Hampton didn't do it. So in addition to, Judge Manning, in addition to Gregory Hubbard, we have Quentin Williams, whose testimony is uncontradicted, that he was there, he was with Patrick Hampton. Patrick Hampton did not participate in the attack. And we also have Gregory Mallory. And Gregory Mallory also testified on behalf of his brother. And he testified, again, in a manner fully consistent with how he testified here at the federal evidentiary hearing, which was, I was at the concert, I witnessed these attacks, I saw my brother, he wasn't involved. Again, Ronald Mallory's jury acquitted him. He also testified, and he would have testified at Patrick Hampton's trial, to the same effect, which was, I was near Patrick Hampton, I was within 5 to 10 feet, that's his testimony, during these attacks, and I didn't see Patrick Hampton go in there. If you take those three witnesses together, or any combination of them, is there a reasonable likelihood that the jury would have discounted the identification testimony? There were substantial reasons the jury had to discount the identification testimony, even without this exculpatory testimony, and there's evidence to that effect. We know the jury had substantial doubts about Hampton's guilt. They sent a note to Judge Strayhorn indicating that they were deadlocked on 4 of the 9 charges, even without any exculpatory testimony, any testimony to contradict the state's identification witnesses. We know that they discounted, or we can reasonably conclude that they discounted Martha's testimony because they acquitted Mr. Hampton of the charge of attempted rape of Martha. So that leaves Denise's testimony. We know that that was subject to attack because Denise identified Ronald Mallory. And when Ronald Mallory presented the kind of witnesses that Mr. Hampton had, the Mallory jury discounted Denise's testimony and acquitted Denise. And then acquitted
Did
Ronald
the jury convict Mallory. On anything with regard to Martha?
Yes, there were some other counts that were, I believe, battery and robbery. that would have been based on an accountability theory.
But the attempted rape was acquitted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There were other things where her identification would at least held up, I guess.
It's not clear that those other convictions were based on her identification. I would submit that they were not, because the judge instructed the jury on accountability theory. And it was clear from the testimony that other individuals battered or robbed Martha, so Patrick Hampton could have been held accountable on those. But he was the only one charged, I believe, with attempt. Well, he was the individual charged with attempting to rape her, and he was acquitted on that particular charge. So it suggests, at least, they discounted her identification testimony. Certainly doesn't conclusively establish it, but there's a reasonable likelihood that they discounted her testimony. So, Your Honors, in summary, if I may, I think the record clearly establishes that the district court properly found that the state court's denial of Mr. Hampton's petition for relief under Strickland was unreasonable. And we ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Whitney. Our thanks to both Ms. Kahn and Mr. Whitney for their fine briefs and presentation today, and the case will be taken under advisement.